doing a sound check just to make sure that you're not annoyed by not hearing us and we aren't stooped over the whole time. So, Ollie, just say a couple words so we can make sure that we're audible.
Good afternoon, everyone. Raise your hands at the back row.
Maybe I'll do something from my youth, long-lived Chairman Mao.
Now we're going to do this.
I think you heard me.
Now we're going to do the ceremonial opening of the water bottles. Today's event is being videotaped, and this videotape will be available for purchase. We're not sure when, but if you have a friend who's missed today's event or if you'd like to review it later, please contact us through our website, and we'd be happy to set you up with a videotape when we figure out how much it's going to cost. We're here today, very pleased that Ollie and Norman have come back to Oak Park, and I want to welcome them back. For those of you who don't know Ollie and Norman from their previous visits to Oak Park, I'll just give a little introduction to each of them. Ollie Abunima is co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and vice president of the Arab American Action Network. He's a public speaker with a comprehensive understanding of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and he appears regularly in national and international broadcast and print media. He's a contributing author to The New Intifada and Live from Palestine. Norman Finkelstein's book, Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, is considered essential reading for students of the conflict. He is the author of Rise and Fall of Palestine and the forthcoming book, Beyond Chutzpah. He received his doctorate from Princeton and currently teaches at DePaul here in Chicago. We're going to try to cover quite a bit of ground today. There have been quite a few developments recently in Israel-Palestine, and we're going to cover them topic by topic, and one of my jobs is to keep us moving along so we hear about all of them and still have time for some questions and answers at the end of the session. So I wanted to start by talking about the recent election in Palestine, and maybe Ali, if you could start by telling us what you think is the significance of Mahmoud Abbas's election.
Well, it depends who you ask. If you look at the newspapers, editorials, listen to world leaders, listen to EU officials, you'd think that this was the most important and significant thing since the moon landings, maybe bigger than that. And there is a whole rhetoric, a whole narrative about Mahmoud Abbas, which is very pleasant, that he is the antidote to Yasser Arafat, who is thankfully dead. That's the undertone of a lot of the narrative. I'm not saying that myself. I'm characterizing the narrative. And since Arafat was the biggest obstacle to peace, Mahmoud Abbas will be the great savior. And so there's been a lot of comment that he wears a silk tie in the media, and since that gets you good coverage, I put on a silk tie. People are taken more seriously, like Mahmoud Abbas. But seriously, who does he represent, and how did he get where he is? And if I can take a minute to address that. He's someone who, we're told, was elected by the Palestinians in an overwhelming majority. This is a small part of the story. There was an election on January 9th in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. It was an election whose outcome was predetermined, and every effort was made to ensure there would not be a real election. So Marwan Barghouti, who tried twice to run for office, who's in Israeli prison, was dissuaded by all of the combined force of the United States, the EU, all of the funders of the Palestinian Authority, by the Palestinian Authority itself. And Mahmoud Abbas was picked as the winner in an opaque process. There was no open primary of any kind. The West Bank and Gaza Strip, there are 8 million registered voters approximately. That's Palestinians, I think, over the age of 18 is the voting age. and 46% of them turned out to vote. So fewer than half of Palestinians bothered to vote in this election. And of those who turned out to vote, approximately 60%, according to the official figures, voted for Mahmoud Abbas. So a minority of Palestinians voted in the occupied territories, but that ignores the fact even that the majority of Palestinians do not live in the occupied territories. There are 9 million Palestinians in the world, and millions of them are refugees, exiles, who were not asked their opinion. And there was a mysterious silence among all of the people who were so enthusiastic about the election of Mahmoud Abbas as to why Palestinian refugees were not afforded a vote. We know it's technically possible. Just look at the Iraqi election, where Iraqis are voting across the United States, in Syria, in Jordan, in Australia. Why weren't Palestinian refugees given a vote? So I think there's a big contrast to be made between the international reception for Abbas and how many Palestinians, if you ask them, feel about him. But since most Palestinians weren't asked, you may never know the answer to that.
Norman, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I basically agree with those comments. Politics is notoriously imprecise, and one usually regrets any predictions one makes. But I would say in this case, one can calculate pretty close to scientific precision the significance of the election. I would say it doesn't hover, it falls squarely at flat zero. This is a repeat of a previous performance, and people rely on the fact that folks have no historical memory in order to try to succeed where they failed before. In December 1995, there were preparations for the first Palestinian election. The most well-known event at that time, which I'll return to in a moment, was the assassination of a fellow named Yahya Ayash.
Ayash.
Right, who was known as the engineer. He was behind many of the military attacks on Israel. In January 1996 was the first Palestinian election. It's forgotten now that exactly the same powers which sought to orchestrate the victory of Mr. Abbas, exactly those same powers sought to orchestrate the victory of Yasser Arafat, who was their great Arab hope or Palestinian hope at the time. So just before the elections, for those who remember these things, Israel withdrew from all the main cities in the occupied territories, and there was great euphoria and optimism among Palestinians. The thought was they would withdraw from the cities. This was a victory of the Oslo process. Yasser Arafat was the one who, on the Palestinian side, initiated the Oslo process. He was therefore credited, and it was meant that he would be credited, with the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the occupied territories. And accordingly, he was awarded in the election with about, the estimate was, I guess it was about 80% of the vote. It may have been even higher. It was only one woman running against him in that election. And the hope was back then that Arafat was now a man of peace and that he would negotiate effectively a Bantustan settlement of occupied territories. And as I mentioned, in December 1995 was the assassination of Ayash. And the purpose behind the assassination was pretty straightforward, I think. It was to test Yasser Arafat whether or not he was going to be a good or a bad quisling for the Israelis. There was a 2-month period of mourning. I don't know exactly how long is it, the period of mourning?
40 days.
And in beginning in February 1996, there were the altogether predictable retaliations by Hamas Many of you will remember them as the successive blowing up of buses between February and March. My recollection is about 3 buses were blown up and about 100 or so Israelis were killed. And now the test was whether Arafat would be a good Quisling and lock up Hamas, which is exactly what he proceeded to do. They said he was going to get tough on the terrorists, exactly like we're told Mr. Abbas is doing now, and he could get tough on the quote-unquote terrorists. He started locking them all up. He then instituted, with huge American pressure, the state security courts, those night court kangaroo courts, which then Vice President Al Gore was very enthusiastic about, where people were given no rights of defense. They took place at 12 o'clock at night, and people were then thrown into prison. And remember, Arafat was really, at that point, living up to his standards as a truly democratic politician. He was torturing numerous Palestinians to death in prison. It was quite a huge scandal at the time, completely forgotten of one Palestinian after another being tortured to death. And that was to prove your credentials to the Americans and the Israelis that you would be a good Quisling. As things happened, as many concessions as Arafat made, there were none forthcoming from the other side. And the rest, most of you pretty much know, the moment of truth came with Camp David, and the prospects of an Arafat Quisling, they expired. And now exactly the same thing is being played out with Mr. Abbas. His victory, as I agree with Ali, his victory was orchestrated by the Americans and the Israelis, and now he has to show that he's going to crack down on the terrorists, exactly like Arafat was supposed to crack down on the terrorists, and one can say with total predictability that, I don't want to say total predictability, but I would say the only differences between now and the first process is it's probably going to be telescoped. Within about 6 months' time, the Palestinians will discover they'll get absolutely nothing for acting as the Israelis' Quislings. They're going to get nothing for it. And what will happen after that, I wouldn't want to try to predict. But the so-called peace process will collapse.
One of the things that I think illustrates what Norman was saying is Ehud Barak, the former Israeli Prime Minister, was on the Charlie Rose show last week, and Charlie Rose asked him about the reaction to Abbas's election in Israel. As you know, Ehud Barak was the Prime Minister until about 2001, and he is from the Labour Party in Israel. So Barak said about Abbas, "Well, the Labour was very happy about the election of Abbas. I say to them," in other words, to his fellow people in the Labour Party who are now part of the Sharon government again, "I say to them, if you embrace Abbas too openly, you'll create problems for him. If you go to him in Ramallah, it will damage his support from the Palestinians. So we must give him justification for putting pressure on terrorists to stop their acts without appearing to welcome him too quickly. If that means we must continue to step up our operations in the West Bank and Gaza, so be it." In other words, what Barak is talking about really is Abbas's job is to do Israel's dirty work, to mop up what Barak calls terrorists, but really any Palestinian who would try to resist in any way Israel's deepening colonization of Palestinian land. And that he even advocates this charade that Abbas, you shouldn't welcome him too warmly. And Sharon didn't make that mistake. He almost immediately cut off relations with Abbas to show, look, we're not going to be soft. And that lasted a few days, and a week later Sharon was praising Abbas very warmly after Abbas deployed Palestinian police to defend Israel. Now this is something that is astonishing to Palestinians, that Palestinians are being killed left, right, and center by the Israeli army, that Palestinian homes are being demolished. This has been going on for years, and not on a single occasion have Palestinian police been deployed to defend Palestinian civilians against the Israeli army. It has never, the few times it happened, in September 1996 and at the beginning of the Intifada, the international community was in uproar and demanded the Palestinian police be disarmed, because their job is not to defend Palestinians, it's to defend Israel. But I want to make the point that Palestinians, even though the turnout was very low in the election on January 9th, Palestinians, should be no surprise, like elections, and they like to vote. And because they have been denied elections for so long, things like student council elections in the West Bank and in Gaza have traditionally taken on an incredible significance, because they've given people a chance to express their support for political groups. And in the municipal elections that were held just a few days ago in the Gaza Strip, there was a very significant turnout, much higher than the turnout in the presidential election, for 118 seats in municipal councils in the Gaza Strip. These were the first municipal elections basically ever. And Hamas won 77 of the 118 seats. And Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah party won 26 of the 118 seats. So that is, a significant measure of where Palestinians' feelings really lie, at least in the Gaza Strip.
I want to just make one other comment. Ali mentioned the silk tie syndrome. There's one aspect I've not been following so closely, but I noticed that at times the most frequent adjective used to describe Abbas is cerebral. And it's kind of amusing to hear that. Mr. Abbas, he did receive a postgraduate degree. He wrote a dissertation proving that the Nazi Holocaust never happened. Presumably he got his degree from Jeddah U or something. But it's very interesting to watch, because had Abbas been an official enemy of the U.S., you can be certain the Holocaust industry would have been hysterical, saying, look at this man, he's a Holocaust denier. And factually, though he claims to have rethought his views, factually, he is a Holocaust denier. But in the case of an official friend of the United States, it makes no difference at all. In fact, he's called cerebral. Go look at the Times. And that tells you a number of things. One is the extent to which the whole hysteria about Holocaust denial is completely manipulative and used for political purposes.
I'd like to talk now about developments in the Gaza Strip, and to start by, maybe Norman, if you could talk about your understanding of what Sharon's plan is for Gaza.
I haven't read in detail. I mean, I've read what an informed person would know about the topic. The Israelis, it is true to say that the Israelis from early on coveted the Gaza. In particular, people like Ben-Gurion wanted Gaza very much in the early years of the founding of the State of Israel. And as some of you may know, during the 1956 war, invasion, the joint French-British-Israeli invasion of Egypt, they occupied the Gaza for a short period of time and committed horrendous massacres there. Literally hundreds were slaughtered by the Israelis. It's a story that's little told. I think an excellent account of it can be found in probably Benny Morris's best work and the least known one, a book called Border Wars, 1949 to 56. It's the only one of his histories where he actually uses Arab sources. He uses a lot of the sources, not only Arab, but UN sources. And once you start using Arab and UN sources, and not just Israeli sources, the history looks very different. And the border wars is even for Morris a kind of aberration, because it truly does look very ugly when you see it through other lenses apart from those of the Israeli eyes. So the Israelis had always coveted Gaza, and they wanted it in 1967. But it's clear by the mid-1970s, and certainly by the 80s, that they had lost interest in the Gaza. Many of you may recall the famous remark by, I think it was Yitzhak Rabin, which was, he wishes that Gaza would just sink into the sea. And they have basically given up interest on it. So it's not altogether surprising that they're now trying to work out a kind of quid pro quo, which is a pretended withdrawal from Gaza in exchange for keeping the West Bank. There was already a precedent for this, namely when they had the media orchestrated withdrawal from the Israeli settlement of Yamit in the Sinai, when the Egyptian-Israeli agreement was reached at, after Camp David. Some of you may recall, those of you who are older, there was a huge hysteria as they watched the settlements be dismantled in Yamit, and we were all supposed to feel very sad and torn about these poor settlers whose homes are being taken away. The expectation back then was, if we give up Yamit, we can keep the West Bank. And now the expectation is a pretended withdrawal from Gaza, with all the media pyrotechnics watching the crying and hysterical Israeli settlers being pulled from their homes, will you be used as a precedent to keep the West Bank? I just have to enter one caveat to that, namely that by international law standards, it is not a withdrawal. There have been numerous statements. My recollection, but you can correct me on this, my recollection is Human Rights Watch has already stated that an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, which leaves it in control of all the entry points and exit points and so on and so forth, even if they do withdraw in that way, they still have under international law, they're still the occupying power. And the same statement was made yesterday by the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Territories, John Dugard, who's a South African trained lawyer. And he said as well that even if they withdraw from the settlements, but they maintain control of the exit and entry points and so on and so forth, under international law, they remain the occupying power. So whatever does happen, it doesn't, under international law, technically change the situation in the Gaza. It's still occupied territory.
I'd like to add a couple of points to what Norman has said. I think the Gaza, you know, one of the interesting things is we all say Gaza disengagement. We all just accept the terminology that Israel has given us. And very few people really are aware of that. The Israelis do not, I would be impressed if the Israelis used the word withdrawal, but that's a word that never crosses the lips of an Israeli official. Because withdrawal has a clear meaning. It has a legal meaning, it has a sort of a day-to-day definition that we all understand. Withdrawal means something is there and you remove it. The Israelis don't like clear language like that, so they use words like disengagement or redeployment. And there was a time when European diplomats or the UN Secretary General would have challenged that and said, no, we need to talk about withdrawal. Now they don't. They simply accept the Israeli terminology. I'm glad Norman I also brought along John Dugard's statement from the UN High Commission for Human Rights. And what it says is precisely as Norman said, so I won't repeat it, that this is not a withdrawal under international law. The occupation will not end in Gaza. And we actually have that report up on the electronic intifada. There are two aspects to the Gaza withdrawal that I think, I'm saying withdrawal, but it's really not. It just goes to show what a trap the language is. The Gaza plan, let's say, to be neutral, that I think is significant. There's the significant on the ground, and there's the political significance. And on the ground, it's clear that the Gaza plan has already been devastating to Palestinians. And in the name of carrying out this so-called disengagement, the Israelis have been engaged in what can only be described as the mass destruction of Palestinian homes, particularly in Rafah in the south and in Beit Hanun in the north. And since the spring, in order to widen the buffer zones around Gaza that Israel will control, and Gaza will be turned into a kind of prison, the Israelis have destroyed the homes of thousands of Palestinian refugees, people who already have been made refugees once, twice, three times now, for a second, third, fourth time. In actions that have been routinely called by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International, by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, war crimes and crimes against humanity. So it's been devastating. The day after the election of Mahmoud Abbas, which was supposed to believe was this great turning point, the Israeli army revealed a plan to demolish up to 3,000 more homes of Palestinian refugees in Rafah. The information that came out was that the Israeli army was going to apply to the Israeli Attorney General, because as we all know, Israel is a country of laws and is like us, and so everything has to be done legally. So before you can commit a crime against humanity, you have to get permission from the legal authorities, who usually grant it. And so this came the day after the election, that Israel would demolish up to 3,000 more homes for the purpose of digging a 25-meter deep or wide, or just a huge trench lined with concrete and filled with water, a moat, a medieval-style moat, to separate the Gaza Strip from Egypt. This is all part of the so-called withdrawal. So that's the significance on the ground. The political significance, I think, was stated most succinctly by Dov Weisglass, Israel's, Ariel Sharon's most senior political advisor, back in October in an interview with Haaretz. And he explained, the significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state. And you prevent a discussion on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. Effectively, this whole package called the Palestinian state, with all that it entails, has been removed indefinitely from our agenda. And all this with authority and permission, all with a presidential blessing and the ratification of both houses of Congress. U.S. presidential blessing, obviously. The disengagement is actually formaldehyde. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. I don't think it could be any clearer than that, and that comment wasn't an aberration, because Sharon made similar comments, though he didn't go quite as far, in an interview with Yediot Aharonot a short time before that. And that is absolutely consistent with Israel's actions. It provides a better explanation for what Israel is doing on the ground in Gaza and the West Bank than the fantasy notion that Israel is preparing to withdraw. But what is interesting is
that despite the clarity of the Israelis about their intentions, this insistence in the international community that the Israelis don't mean what they're saying. It's bizarre. The Israelis are telling you point blank that they have no intention of this leading to any kind of permanent or viable peace. But you have Tony Blair and Kofi Annan and all the rest of them running around saying, no, no, the Gaza disengagement is part of the roadmap. It all leads to peace. But the Israelis are telling you, no, 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 don't, please, believe us. Don't believe the Israelis. Very strange, the unwillingness to face reality. So I think this is partly why I've come to conclude that what we're dealing with is no longer a sincere effort to make peace, but a peace process industry, not entirely reminiscent of the Holocaust industry that Norman has described, but a collection of diplomats, leaders, think tanks, pundits, who all talk on a plane which has absolutely nothing to do with the reality on the ground. And that if you insist on talking about what's happening on the ground, you are marginal, you're an extremist, you're not interested in peace, you're not credible. You just have to talk about, keep saying roadmap and peace process and disengagement and smile and everything will be all right. And this is the stage we've gotten where there is a basic lack of honesty that has become so mind-numbing and frustrating, and that we have to break through.
I want to just make a couple of comments on that. First of all, on the question of the demolition of homes in the Gaza, which is, by any reckoning, a colossal human rights crime. There's been very excellent human rights reports published by all the main human rights organizations, as well as the local ones in the Israel-Palestine area. And they've gone through systematically many of the kinds of justifications that Israel has put forth for the house demolitions. Most of you are, for example, no doubt familiar with the claim about the massive smuggling of weapons through tunnels from Egypt into homes in the border area on Gaza. And in fact, there is evidence that there has been some smuggling going on. The main report that came out from the Human Rights Watch goes through the figures, and I guess there were about, don't quote me on it, but my memory is they found about 90 tunnels or something in that area. The more important point, however, is that as Human Rights Watch points out, there's problems with tunnel smuggling in many parts of the world. There are problems with tunnel smuggling along the Korean border. There are problems with tunnel smuggling along the U.S.-Mexican border, and U.S.-Mexican border drugs smuggling through tunnels. But in no other instance in the world have they resorted to house demolitions in order to block that kind of smuggling. There are all sorts of alternative technologies available, all sorts of different options available in order to, if you think it's legitimate, I think it's an open question, but I'm not going to debate it. If you think it's legitimate to block the smuggling of weapons from Egypt into Gaza, there are all sorts of alternatives to this mammoth, massive destruction of homes that's going on a daily basis. The other point I would want to make, and we'll soon get to it when we talk about the issue of the wall, is I think the picture at an international level is a mixed one. I agree with Ali that there is a whole array of diplomats, organizations that are certainly following the drumbeat of the U.S. and Israel. But I think the picture in other areas is not quite as bleak and offers reason for optimism. I would also want to add, and we shouldn't be oblivious to the fact, that one of the partners to the peace process industry is the Palestinian leadership. Were it not for their cooperation, their complicity in this peace, so-called peace process, I very much doubt it would have anywhere near the kind of success it's currently enjoying.
I want to talk about one other aspect of the Gaza withdrawal, and that would be its opposition by the settlers who live in Gaza and the people who support those settlers within Israel. I have three articles here. The earliest one comes from November of 2004, talking about collecting signatures. At that point, it was 3,000 soldiers, mostly reservists, who have declared they will not evacuate settlements. Here's something from the Jerusalem Post in January. A leader of the radical anti-disengagement camp told the Post on Wednesday that he's confident of having support inside the security forces opposing the plan. We have a big surprise in store for the IDF. We have our people embedded within their ranks. And when it comes down to evacuation, we'll know every single detail. This from Arut 7, the grassroots organization Women in Green is collecting signatures, and it's projected that the total number of soldiers who have signed on to various versions of this petition now numbers at 10,000. Could either or both of you talk about the consequences of refusal and rumors of civil war and disruption within Israel to a disengagement plan?
I think that's mostly theater. I don't think it has much to do with reality. There are four former intelligence chiefs from Israel, you may recall about a year ago, who made a statement supporting the Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories or talking about the horrendous crimes that are being committed by the IDF in the occupied territories. And one of the intelligence chiefs was asked a question pretty close to this one, akin to this one. He was asked, if you attempt to withdraw, what about the problem of violent resistance from the settlers and from their confederates in the Israeli society? And the intelligence chief, I can't quote him exactly now, but he replied that all we have to do is treat them like we treat Hamas, and they'll leave very quickly. If you treat them with kid gloves, there's a problem. But one has to recall in every other historical example, when you attempt a withdrawal or a fundamental reconstitution of society, there is some elements that are going to reject it. They did it in Algeria. In the case of South Africa, you may recall in the last years when they were negotiating the settlement with the ANC, there were security forces which were working together with Inkatha, the Chief Buthelezi's group in KwaZulu, and committed terrible massacres, no question about it. They're capable of doing harm and causing bloodshed, and nobody should trivialize the loss of anybody's life. But nonetheless, the notion they represent a major obstacle or problem to affecting a withdrawal, I think, is sheer nonsense. It's a theater.
Holly, do you mind if we move on without you commenting on that? Okay. I'd like to talk now about, while attention is focused on developments in Gaza, have an update on what's happening in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, demographically, militarily, security issues, and also related to the construction of the separation barrier.
Well, the situation in the West Bank, in occupied Jerusalem and Gaza Strip, is the same as it was, only more so. And I'll give you some recent information. On January 8th, the day before the famous election, Haaretz published, that's the main Israeli newspaper, sort of the newspaper of record of Israel, published a lengthy report by Aluf Ben, headlined, "Quietly Carrying On Building." It was a very long report about the sheer amount of new settlement construction, Jewish-only settlements in the occupied territories. well worth reading. But it made two points that I think very significant, in fact, crucial to understanding what's going on, and yet made no impact whatsoever on how recent events have been covered or discussed by the peace process industry. The two points. One is that the article reported that Israel is currently drawing up construction plans in 120 settlements across the occupied West Bank with the full approval and knowledge of the new Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. And it quoted an Israeli government official saying, you know, this makes perfect sense. And in fact, it does, as he put it. If the U.S. recognizes your claim that the settlement box will remain yours forever, why should it make a fuss when you build on your own property? And it reported that according to Peace Now, the Israeli Peace Now, which is acknowledged even by the settlers as doing the best documentation of settlement construction in the occupied territories. Peace Now said the main building effort in the Jewish settlements in the West Bank is now focused on the area between the green line and the separation fence, and it is an aim at turning the fence into Israel's permanent border. What does that mean? Israel built a system of walls in the occupied West Bank, which the International Court of Justice last July found to be illegal and ordered the immediate dismantlement of this wall. That hasn't happened. Israel has continued to build it, disregarding the ICJ opinion. Israel argued, though, all along that the wall is, the Palestinian claim was that this is not about security, because if Israel were interested in security, it could build a wall along the 1967 border. This is really a land grab, because Israel is building well inside the occupied West Bank. Now we have the data from Peace Now, which shows quite conclusively that it's a land grab. Whatever the intention, that is the result, that Israel is now engaged in a massive settlement construction effort to make the wall the permanent border, which means that any prospect for a Palestinian state would be in these little broken up ghettos or Bantustans. A couple of other developments since the election of President Abbas. On January 24th, it was revealed that the Israeli cabinet plans to revive the 1950s era absentee property law, which Israel used after 1948 to expropriate the property of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Basically, they passed a law which says that if you are absent from your property for a certain period of time, then you forfeit your title to it and the State of Israel takes it over. Of course, if you're absent because the State of Israel won't let you reach your property, then this is just a legal nicety in order to expropriate people. So Israel has revived the absentee property law in Jerusalem so that the property of thousands of Palestinians who are residing in areas near Jerusalem but who can't reach it because of the separation wall will now forfeit their property. And that from July, Palestinians in Palestinian Jerusalem, Jerusalemites, will not be permitted to leave Jerusalem without permits from the Israeli authorities, which essentially means they can't leave because it's very difficult to get permits from the Israeli authorities to do anything if you're a Palestinian. And again, the intention here is to totally separate occupied Jerusalem and the areas around it which Israel has annexed from the rest of the occupied West Bank, and to bring the so-called consensus settlements, places like Ma'ale Adumim and Gilo, and places which even Israeli peaceniks don't challenge Israel's right to keep, even though they are settlements the same as the ones in Hebron or the ones in the Golan Heights, to bring them within Israel and to completely isolate the Palestinians in Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank, either to force those Palestinians out or just simply to make sure that there can be no Palestinian capital, if it were ever to come to that, in Jerusalem. And what this looks like on the ground again, today's Haaretz reports the following. I just pulled this off the Haaretz website minutes before coming here. Headline: Border Police Plans to Destroy Arab Neighborhood in Jerusalem. Headline you won't see in the New York Times. And I'll just read you the first two sentences. The Border Police is planning to demolish an Arab neighborhood in Jerusalem to protect the separation fence built in the area. Commander Amitai Levy, the Border Police Commander of the area enveloping Jerusalem, has announced that dozens of buildings of the Al-Multar neighborhood in Jerusalem's Sur Baher village must be torn down. This follows his decision to create a 500-meter-wide security strip on each side of the barrier along its entire length. The residents of Al-Multar said this week that at least 74 houses come within 500 meters of the barrier. In the rest of the country, the security buffer along the fence is only 50 to 80 meters wide. Again, it goes to show the arbitrariness of these sorts of things. And consider, I mean, just let's take this at face value for a moment. Jerusalem is a much smaller city than Chicago. Now, can you imagine a security barrier 500 meters on each side, 1 kilometer wide, that's two-thirds of a mile wide, through the middle of Chicago? You'd have to demolish half the loop to do that. And that's in a city the size of Chicago. And it happened in Chicago when they built the expressways. They demolished entire neighborhoods. We've forgotten it now. But, you know, even the Kennedy Expressway isn't two-thirds of a mile wide. So this is just to give you a sense of what's going on the ground every day, relentlessly, unchanged, unresponsive to all of the rhetoric of a window of opportunity, and the entire peace process industry pretends it isn't happening. The result of this is clear. The result of this violence, this daily violence, will be more violence from the Palestinians. And when that happens, you'll hear about it. And we'll be told, oh, Palestinians trying to wreck the peace process again.
I'll just briefly add that everything that Ali described was the predicted and intended outcome of the current second round of the peace process. During the so-called Oslo peace process years, between September 1993 and May 2002, during that 10-year period where we were supposedly bearing witness to a peace process, the settler population in the West Bank, the settler population roughly doubled, went from about 200,000 to 400,000. The number of settlements came to encompass approximately 50% of the land of the occupied territories. And appropriately, in 2002, that Selam, Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, put out a very thick study entitled Land Grab. And so it was entirely appropriate that Ali should use the expression again. This is the second round of the land grab to further consolidate Israeli control over the occupied territories. While everybody is fixated on the question of whether or not Abbas is going to crack down on the terrorists. Exactly as in 1996-97, the only question the media was, as these settlements were massively expanding, the only question the media was whether Arafat was going to crack down on the terrorists. They're succeeding.
I want to move now to a topic that's not doesn't have to do with current events and recent developments, but to have a conversation now about this upsurge that seems to be happening in discussion about one state and two state solutions. First of all, to figure out if this is actually enough surge at all, if it's something that's existed all along, if we're seeing something that's new and different from what's come along before. In trying to prepare for this part of the presentation, it became clear to me that there are Palestinians and Israelis who advocate one state and two state solutions. There are many different reasons for each of them to support each possible solution. So the picture is it's not a polarized situation. That's one observation to make. And the other is that there are solutions that are being discussed or contemplated that fall into the none of the above category. I'd like to start by reading a couple excerpts that seem to be in support of the one state sort of idea, and then have Ali and Norman comment on the content of those. The first one comes from Michael Tarazi, who's a legal advisor to the PLO. Michael says, "Support for the one state is hardly a radical idea. It is simply the recognition of the uncomfortable reality that Israel and the occupied territories already function as a single state. In the words of one Palestinian farmer, you can't unscramble an egg." And Tony Jute, who is director of the Remark Institute at NYU, got quite a bit of reaction to an essay he wrote in October 2003 in the New York Review of Books. The piece was called Israel the Alternative. And one of his central arguments in that was that the very idea of a Jewish state, a state in which Jews and Jewish religion have exclusive privileges from which non-Jewish citizens are forever excluded, is rooted in another time and place. Israel, in short, is an anachronism. A different kind of argument than the demographic one. Here's an Israeli author, Daniel Gavron, who calls himself a Zionist but believes that because the settlement project has expanded to the point where it's essentially irreversible, circumstances have progressed to the point where one state is the only possible outcome. Norman, could you start by talking about reacting to these things and also reflecting on your own opinion of this?
Well, at this point, for better or for worse, there are many things to say about it. I'm not for two states, I'm not for one state, I'm old-fashioned, I'm for no states. But for those of you who didn't applaud, no doubt you didn't applaud among other reasons, because my particular ideological commitment to no states has no bearing on the real world as we presently know it. And I think that's a perfectly fair objection, not to be facetious now, because, and here we ought to get serious, not that I'm reprimanding you, I'm speaking to myself. We're talking about the real lives of real human beings who are daily undergoing horrific suffering. Just in a personal note, I occasionally think I want to drop this whole Palestine thing because it consumed almost the whole of my adult life. And then last night I was doing my homework and reading the article about the land confiscations in Jerusalem. And once again, I found my blood boiling and thinking I just can't walk out on it. So our first concern has to always be keeping in mind, we're talking about the real lives of real people and what we can do to affect an improvement in their lives. Having said that as the context, I don't think the question is whether you think one state or two states is preferable, or in my own opinion, no states. The question we want to ask ourselves is, what is most likely, what is the approach which is most likely to bring about a reduction in the misery of the Palestinians? I'm not using a positive formula, an improvement in their lives. And at this point, I think we're talking about a reduction in their misery. And to the extent that I don't think they're contradictory, an improvement as well in the lives of Israelis, who many, I assume, and I see no reason why not to assume, would like to build a decent, just society of their own. Having said that, I haven't heard a single argument as to why we should suddenly be embracing this one-state formula. Politically, I don't think it has any bearing whatever on the real world. And it's a kind of peculiarity, a real peculiarity, which is bothersome, that just at the point where the international community, at least at one level, I'm not talking about the daily diplomatic rhetoric of the pitiful Kofi Annan, who seems to be willing to do anything to maintain, preserve his job as Secretary General of the UN. Not the level of the daily rhetoric, but the level of an international consensus which is solid, which is remarkably united in support of the Palestinian rights to self-determination, a full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, and so on and so forth. We finally achieved that. That's not a small accomplishment. Anyone, for example, who had an opportunity not just to read the coverage of the World Court decision, but to read the actual decision itself, would have had a feeling of almost being dumbfounded. From beginning to end, the World Court endorsed 14-1 with a partial dissent from the American judge, endorsed every single aspect of the international consensus for resolving the conflict. I don't have time now to go through every point, but beginning with the most elementary semantical question, the World Court says at the beginning of the decision, some people call this a wall. Some people call it a fence. Some people call it a barrier. We've examined all the arguments. We're going to call it a wall. And from there on in, it said explicitly, Israel must execute a full withdrawal from all of the occupied territories, including Jerusalem. It said the Fourth Geneva Conventions are applicable to the occupied territories, and on and on. Even the American judge, in his statement, declared that the settlements, all of the settlements, were illegal under international law. Now that consensus, with the partial dissent of the Americans, that consensus represents a tremendous victory for the cause of a just and lasting two-state settlement of the conflict. When we have reached that point, we've reached the point that if you look at any UN General Assembly resolution on Palestine, there are six dissents on every single resolution. The United States, Israel, Palu, Nauru, Tuvalu, the Micronesia, and the Federated States, and the Marshall Islands. Seven dissents. That's it. In the entire world, look for any resolution. And often it's not even Nauru, Tuvalu, and Palu who opt out. It just becomes the United States and Israel. Just at the point where we finally achieved something significant, people are now throwing around this idea of let's get rid of the two-state settlement, let's talk about one state. Now, the logic of this totally mystifies me. The argument typically put is, we've not had any success with the two-state settlement, so let's move to the one-state settlement. If you've not had any success with a program that's supported by the entire international community, bar two exceptions, if you've not had any success with a program supported by the international community in total, why do you think you'll have more success with a program which currently enjoys zero international support? That doesn't make any sense to me. What I think is going on is
People are frustrated. They don't see progress. And in part, there's truth to that. No question, the situation progressively gets and rapidly gets worse in the occupied territories. No question about that. But here it seems to me we have to, instead of playing with slogans, what we have to do is we have to be a little more self-critical. And by that I mean the reason, I hate to quote the cliche from Julius Caesar, but the problem is not in the stars, the problem is in ourselves. We have not made the kind of effort, we have not invested the kind of energy which could capitalize in significant ways on the victories which, miraculously, we've won. To take just the example I cited a moment ago, what happened to the World Court decision? It was an incredible victory and a considerable investment of energy. What happened to it? Did that become the center of a campaign? Did it become a mobilizing slogan to enforce the World Court decision? It got completely forgotten, disappeared. People forget. Israel was terrified at that World Court deliberation. It couldn't decide whether or not to send somebody to The Hague to argue the case. There was all sorts of debate and discussion in Israel. Well, they lost. But did we win? No. Nothing came of it. And that, to me, is the tragedy. We never capitalize on our victories. We don't show courage. We don't make sacrifices. Ms. Ali talks about a peace process industry. Yes, there is one. But I'm afraid, I'll use a figure, perhaps I'll regret it, but I think that 90% of those who claim they're fighting for Palestinian rights are part of the industry. They're bored off. They go to their conferences, they go traveling, they feel like they're important. They're all, I'm sorry to say, they're all sellouts. And that's the problem. No courage, no energy, no investment, no sacrifice, no willingness to sacrifice. That's why we're losing. Not because of the slogan. It's not the slogan, it's us.
I want to approach this issue with some thought, and so bear with me, because I want to try to get at some of the things that Norman said and other things that, that he didn't address. Norman said that the ICJ decision is a significant victory, and it is, no doubt. I certainly welcomed it, and I was also very critical of the fact that the Palestinian leadership did not. They put it in the drawer and they forgot about it. And precisely because of the reasons that Norman stated, they are sellouts. But I think it's easy to overblow the importance of the ICJ decision when you put it in historical context. Let me read you from a Security Council decision. This is UN Security Council Resolution 465 of 1980. It says, it has a long preamble, and then it says that the Security Council determines that all measures taken by Israel to change the physical character, demographic composition, institutional structure, or status of the Palestinian and other Arab territories occupied since 1967, including Jerusalem or any part thereof, have no legal validity, and that Israel's policy and practices of settling parts of its population and new immigrants to those territories constitute a flagrant violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention relative to the protection of civilian persons in time of war, and also constitute a serious obstruction to achieving a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace. The Security Council strongly deplores the continuation and persistence of Israel in pursuing those policies and practices, and calls upon the government and people of Israel to rescind those measures, to dismantle the existing settlements, and in particular to cease on an urgent basis the establishment, construction, and planning of settlements in the Arab territories occupied since 1967, including Jerusalem. I read you one sentence from UN Security Council Resolution 471 of June 5, 1980, which, after a long preamble, reaffirms, the Security Council reaffirms the overriding necessity to end the prolonged occupation of Arab territories occupied since 1967, including Jerusalem. Now, why do I read you those Security Council resolutions? You could not get texts like these through the Security Council today. It's absolutely impossible. You wouldn't only have a US veto, the Europeans wouldn't vote for these texts anymore. So, does the ICJ decision really represent progress? No. At best, it's a reaffirmation of things which were said by the Security Council decades ago and forgotten. It doesn't break any new legal ground. It repeats what the Security Council refuses to say now. The reason the Palestinians had to go to the ICJ is because they can no longer get a resolution like this through the Security Council. They can't, they're even having trouble in the General Assembly. This year, for the first time, Canada, our friendly neighbor to the north, joined with Israel and the United States for the first time in voting against resolutions affirming basic Palestinian rights. I don't agree that the Palestinians are making progress. I don't agree that it's for lack of our effort. I don't think there are many people in the world who could have shown the steadfastness and fortitude that Palestinians have shown on the ground against Israel's colonization. I do agree that there is an international consensus for a Palestinian state. This, everyone is talking about it. I mean, President Bush can't get enough of the idea. But it has been totally emptied of any content. A Palestinian state is useful to Palestinians if it is a vehicle for regaining their usurped rights and guaranteeing their human and political rights. But it is not. That is the slogan. A Palestinian state has become the slogan. Because what is talked about now by this whole international consensus is a state which has no ability to guarantee to its erstwhile citizens their basic civic, political, and human rights. So Israel has now accepted a Palestinian state in name, but after having emptied a state of its content. I think it's a mistake to frame this as about whether do you support a one-state solution or do you support a two-state solution. And Martha, I'm going to disagree slightly with your formulation at the beginning when you said this discussion has nothing to do with current events. It has everything to do with current events. The fact that, occupation under international law, under the Geneva Conventions, is a temporary condition. The Fourth Geneva Conventions forbid an occupying power from making all but the smallest changes in the status of the occupied territory. Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza have been occupied for 40 years. More than 70% of the population in those territories are under the age of 30. So the vast majority of Palestinians living in those territories were born under the occupation. Israel has built settlements for 400,000 Israelis in the occupied territories. They are linked by a network of infrastructure that cannot be easily dismantled. Physically it can. You can blow anything up, as the United States has demonstrated repeatedly in recent years. Anything can be blown up. But politically, removing the entire peace movement, all of the diplomatic efforts, all of the UN Security Council resolutions, did not stop the construction of a single apartment in the occupied territories. They did not stop the construction of a single apartment. And I don't think it's right to say because we didn't try hard enough. We could always have done more, but I don't think that if we stopped 1% of the settlements, I'd say, okay, we didn't. We could have done more, but we have not succeeded. And I don't say that as a judgment. I think it's an observation of where we are. That the settlements are proceeding apace. You have not only generations of Palestinians born under the occupation, but you have generations of Israelis born in the settlements who've been shaped by the settlements. And when we say, again, the slogan is a Palestinian state, it's a slogan. It's a slogan, why? Because it means everything, a different thing to every person. Sharon, to Bush, to Ehud Barak, to Mahmoud Abbas, to a Palestinian in Lebanon, they all have a different notion. When you say end the occupation, that's also a slogan. It has become a slogan. Why? Because we don't know what we mean anymore when we say end the occupation. We're not talking about withdrawing an army and their tents and their equipment. If you say to Israel, if you do an opinion poll and say to Israelis, should we end the occupation, you'll get 80% who say yes. Say, should we dismantle Gilo and Ma'ale Adumim, you'll get 75% who say no. But Ma'ale Adumim is a settlement. It's in the West Bank. It's illegal under UN's resolution 465 and 471. But even the so-called peace camp in Israel believe that all of the settlements around Israel are part of Israel. So you can't even get agreement anymore on what end the occupation means. And you have now an international peace process industry which believes that Sharon's disengagement plan is compatible with the roadmap to peace, and that the roadmap to peace is a way to peace. And all of this can be achieved only with vagueness. Everything is vague, and the occupation is vague. What a Palestinian state will be is vague. When a Palestinian state will be achieved is vague. We were told that last year that it would be by 2005. Yesterday, or the day before, President Bush said a Palestinian state will be achieved ahead of schedule in 2009. Ahead of schedule. So we can all agree on a Palestinian state if we all agree not to go into any detail about what that state is. We can all agree end the occupation, as long as we don't ask too many questions about what ending the occupation means. We can all agree on a Palestinian state within the 1967 borders, as long as we don't worry too much about where the 1967 border actually is in reality. So, with vagueness, we can create a consensus. When it gets down to the precision of are the Israelis going to withdraw 400,000 settlers? No, of course not. No, they're not. Are they going to withdraw Ariel and Ma'ale Adumim and Gilo and Ramat and all of these new settlements that are going up? No, they're not. Are we any closer to getting those settlements removed or dismantled? No. We're no closer than we were when UN Resolution 465 was passed in 1980. in fact, were much further away, because in 1980 there were fewer than 100,000 settlers in the West Bank. Now there are more than 400,000. So this isn't a question of whether one believes in the one state or two states. It's a question of recognizing the reality that Israel has created, which is that there is, in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, half the population approximately who are Jews and half the population who are non-Jews. And they are quite intermixed. I mean, they're not intermixed in terms of their day-to-day life necessarily, but where they are located is very much intermixed. And what you begin to have now, as a result of Israel's policy, is a situation, here's the good news, that looks a lot like Northern Ireland. Which means that there is no territorial settlement. There's no line you can draw which satisfies 51% of Israelis and 51% of Palestinians. Any partition line that you draw that satisfies 51% of Israelis will be rejected by 90% of Palestinians and vice versa. And that's not even taking account of the refugees whom this international consensus has agreed to pretend don't exist. That's not even taking into account their opinion. So we've reached a stage where, to me, I'm not in favor of one state or two states. I really don't care. What I'm interested in is the fulfillment of the rights of Palestinians. And if I believe that there were a possibility of an independent Palestinian state coming into being that could do that, I would be in favor of it. If I believe that that could best be achieved by the creation of a single state for Palestinians and Israelis, that's what I would favor. Right now, they both seem to me equally unlikely. What does that mean? Where does that place us? It places us in a situation where we're at a total strategic impasse, and we have the choice to ridicule if I'm faced with two equally unlikely or two equally likely scenarios. I'm going to take them both on their merits, and I'm going to discuss them. And I'm not going to submit to there being taboos. I'm going to talk about them openly. And I am just not convinced, as someone who is Palestinian, both of my parents were born in Palestine, both of them left as refugees, I'm not convinced that Israelis and Palestinians are so special and so different and so unique on this earth that they can't get along the way French people and Germans do today, the way South Africans do. Admittedly, South Africa is no picnic, but it's better than apartheid. I'm not, you know, we talk in the world about conflict. We always focused on conflict. We forget that the world is also full of resolved conflicts. And I'm just not convinced that Israelis and Palestinians are so special, that they can never live together, that they always have to be separate. But living together in a democracy is somehow so alarming and terrifying to Israelis that they could never come to terms with it. I don't accept it. When you look today in the atrocious situation that Israel has created, even within its borders, for its non-Jewish citizens, Palestinians and Israelis in Haifa live together. We're always told that Haifa is a model of cooperation and coexistence. Haifa is a model of coexistence, even though Palestinian citizens of Israel are second-class citizens, even though they're not allowed to buy land. And yet, they still exist with Israelis, work with them, go to restaurants together, go to schools together. All of this happens in Haifa. Under the extreme situation we have now. Now, supposing, how much better would things be in Haifa if Palestinian citizens of Israel actually had equality? Let's take the Haifa model and expand it. Now, to me, you might think that's unrealistic, and impossible, you might reach that conclusion. All I'm saying is let's discuss it seriously. I mean, let's have an open discussion about it, without fear, without prejudice. And that, I think, is the point we've reached, because the approach we have taken so far, it's not right to say whether it's failed or not failed. I don't think we can make that judgment now. But what we can say is we are further away from a viable, independent Palestinian state in the 1967 borders than at any time in history. That's my conclusion. And that requires us to discuss all things.
Norman, I know you've been jotting down a lot of notes and you have many things to say. Yes, we can do that. I want to throw one other issue into this, something that hasn't been addressed at all, and that is the sincere feeling on the part of many Jews that Israel is a necessity, that the existence of a Jewish state is a necessary outcome given the history of chronic anti-Semitism and persecution. And regardless how you feel about that formulation, if a Jewish state is an appropriate response to history, whether you agree or disagree with that, there are many people for whom that is a very heartfelt conviction, and that sentiment is something to be dealt with when we consider possible future outcomes and who advocates what. So I wondered if you would talk about that as well as other things as you respond to Ali Norman.
Well, I agree that we're at an impasse now. The prospects look bleak. The only relevant and reasonable question is to ask, why is that so? Now, regrettably, I think the first part of Ali's presentation would have brought smiles to the face of most apologists for Israeli rejectionism. He said that this whole slogan of a Palestinian state, it's vague. It's open to many interpretations. Who knows what it means? Maybe it means full withdrawal. Maybe it means partial withdrawal. Maybe it's simply the camouflage for a bantustan. Now, I have read arguments like that. I read them by Alan Dershowitz, I hear them by Mr. Sharon, and I hear it by a lot of media spinners who want to conflate what a two-state settlement has historically meant and still does mean under international law with what they want people to believe it means. But it's not vague. It's not open to every manner of interpretation. It's not ambiguous. And what was quite interesting was even a very conservative world court was very explicit about the meaning of Israel's obligations under international law. It said, some of you may recall, in the famous debates over UN Resolution 242, there was a whole question about whether, because the definite article the was omitted, Israel must withdraw from occupied territories. It didn't say the occupied territories. There was all manner of claim by Israel's apologists that this means that UN Resolution 242 sanctions a partial Israeli withdrawal. Oh no, said the World Court. It has to be a full withdrawal to the pre-June 1967 borders, and Jerusalem is a part of the occupied territories. They were very explicit about that. Now for us, on our side, to join in with Israel's apologists and claim this whole talk about a two-state settlement is vague and ambiguous, I think, is a disaster. Why
if the World Court judgment had no major implications, why did Israel dread it? Why did Israel fear it? Why were there all these debates about whether or not to participate in the World Court adjudication? No, there's not a problem of ambiguity there. We know exactly what it means. And at the judicial level, and to the extent that you can speak of an international legislative level in the UN, we had tremendous victories, largely owing to the struggle of the Palestinian people and despite its leadership. The problem is not the ambiguity of these resolutions. The problem is not the ambiguity of a two-state settlement. The problem is we, our side, never capitalizes on those victories. And here we can learn a great deal from the other side. Because say what you want about the Zionists, they did know, and they do know, how to capitalize on every victory, however small. Who would have ever heard of the Balfour Declaration 10 years after its issuance, let alone a century later, were it not for the fact that the Zionists ran with it? All it was one paragraph issued by an obscure and not too bright foreign minister of Great Britain. But they ran with those words. They capitalized on it. They invested in it. They made it a landmark in history. The same thing, who would have ever heard of UN General Assembly Resolution 181? It was just a General Assembly recommendation. It barely passed with a two-thirds majority. The vote was 55-15-10 in the General Assembly. It was just a recommendation. That was the partition resolution. The Israelis ran with it, or the Zionists then, later the Israelis, ran with it. Some of you may know that history. By February and March 1948, civil war was breaking out in Palestine. Truman was ready to abandon 181. And he put forth a proposal in February, March 48 to put Palestine under an international trusteeship because this two-state thing isn't going to work. The partition resolution of 47, that two-state. The Zionists, they mobilized here to put pressure on Truman, and they went right ahead there. They knew how to capitalize on their victories. We not only don't capitalize on our victories, but now I'm being told they weren't really much of victories at all. That's not the way you win a struggle. Finally, I agree that trying to get Israelis to dismantle settlements will be difficult. I have no doubt about that. I think at Camp David and Taba, proposals were put forth which could finesse that problem. And the proposals seemed, I'm not saying it was the answer, but the proposals seemed reasonable. Not to go into the details now, but for on the Palestinian side, the one-for-one land swap of equal value and equal size land. There were proposals put forth. But we have to then use a common sense, or ask a commonsensical question. The question is, which is more likely to happen? Israel dismantles settlements, or Israel become a binational state? Which is more likely to happen? I recognize they're both difficult, but which is more likely to happen? And here I have to say to Ali, with all due respect, I am against all taboos. I have students of mine, or ex-students of mine, in the audience. They know I'm a great believer in John Stuart Mill. Everything is open to debate. Everything is open to discussion. No taboos. Agreed. But there's a problem about investing time and energy. What should we be doing with our time and energy? Should we be squandering it in this debate, and I think it is squandering, or should we be mobilizing our energies, investing our efforts into exposing Israel's crimes, exposing Israel's violations of international law, and projecting the victories we already have, projecting them on the population and turning them into a political force. That's our problem. We don't turn our victories into a political force. I'll just end on one note. I was reading an interesting book a few months ago by this fellow named Swisher on the Camp David and Taba negotiations. And the Palestinian representatives, they go to Camp David, they meet with Clinton, and they meet with Albright, and Clinton, Albright, they don't want to offer the Palestinians the full withdrawal. They have all sorts of, proposals, basically that Israel should be allowed to keep 8 or 10% of the occupied territories. And at one point, the Palestinian negotiator, he said, that's not fair, because UN General Assembly resolution, or Security Council resolution, I'm not sure which, a 425, called for a full Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon. And Israel fully withdrew from Lebanon. So why is it, if Israel must fully withdraw from Lebanon, they don't have to fully withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza? Well, I had to kind of laugh at that, because of course that makes legal sense, and of course that's just, and of course that's right. But of course it has nothing whatever to do with politics. Israel withdrew from all of Lebanon because they were kicked out of all of Lebanon. Not because they were fulfilling a UN resolution. And if these Palestinian negotiators would have spent a little less time in the Ritz Hotel in Washington and a little more time mobilizing and organizing their people, and if their representatives and supporters here would invest a little less time in debating intellectual issues fit for the pages of the New York Review of Books by people who never ever lifted a finger for any struggle and any people's justice, that's just not what we should be doing. I'm not saying we should do what Hezbollah did, but there's a huge range of options between doing what the Palestinian leadership and folks do in the New York Review of Books and what the Hezbollah did. There's a huge range, and that range should be filled by us, not squandering time debating one state or two states, but sitting down, reading those human rights reports, gaining the facts, gaining the figures, and then organizing, mobilizing, and most importantly, isolating Israel's apologists in the United States and elsewhere. That's what we should be doing, in my opinion.
I'm actually surprised at the lack of response Norman gave to what I said. I think that I certainly don't want to give the impression that I don't know what a fulfillment of international law would look like. I think it's quite precisely described in the UN resolutions I read out and in the ICJ decision. The trouble is there isn't a single international official, US official, European official, UN official, Arab official, Palestinian official, who is willing to say that international law should be implemented. Not one. And when you say, well, what are you going to do about the settlements? As Norman said, well, there was some formula, Tarbaugh, Camp David, a one-to-one land swap. These ideas sound fine until you look at the detail. And then when you try to say, well, what does it really mean? You find that it is in every case, in every proposal that has been put forward, it has been a ratification of Israel's land grabs. Just described as something else. This goes for Camp David, for Tarbaugh, for the Geneva Initiative, for the Clinton proposals, for the Mitchell proposals, whatever, you name it, the whole list. Now, my point is that you cannot take George Bush. It's not that I don't know what a Palestinian state ought to look like if such a thing were possible. It's that my point is you can't take George Bush's support for it or Tony Blair's support for it as evidence that you're making headway. Because what George Bush means by a Palestinian state has nothing to do with the implementation of international law. So Norman is contradicting himself when he says there's this great international consensus towards a Palestinian state.
Except the U.S. and Israel. I think I said that 20 times.
Yes, but Norman, it isn't except the U.S. and Israel. The EU, which used to take positions on things like settlements and things like international law, has abandoned those positions. The EU is now in with Israel and the United States. Canada has abandoned its position and is now voting with Israel and the United States in the General Assembly. Jordan has abandoned its position. Egypt has abandoned its position. So, in fact, there is an international consensus for something called the Palestinian state, but it is not what you would get by applying international law. And I want to make a final point. I'm going to make a prediction. It's easy to dismiss this discussion and say it's wandering time. I'll make a prediction. When, as Norman described it, the attempt to repeat what happened to the Arafat fails again, as it will, and I agree it will be telescoped, we will be left. The peace process industry will not be able to find another Abbas or another way to cover up this gate. And we will be left with the reality that Israel has created a situation in which a Palestinian state is unviable and impractical. And as a direct result of doing that, a Jewish state is also unviable and impractical. And I predict that that realization will come within the next few years. In which case, this academic debate, which Norman says is not even fit for the New York Review of Books, is going to be something we are all going to have to grapple with. And I understand why Norman is terrified of it, because it's scary for all of us. But I do think we're going to have to grapple with it, and we're going to have to recognize that simply clinging to the ideas of the past is not going to save us in the reality that Israel has created. And we have to just, well, I suppose we'll have to come back in a year. I'm sorry, Martha, I know you have to move on, but 1 year ago, almost to the day, Norman and I met on a panel at the University of Chicago. It's February 12th. And he made many of the same points, although I think he made them better last year. And he said, you know, he said all the same things. He said it would be immoral was the word he used, to advocate for a single state as long as there was a chance of a full Israeli withdrawal that could lead to the creation of a Palestinian state. And then someone in the audience asked him, well, Professor Finkelstein, how do you rate the chances of a full Israeli withdrawal? And he said, do you remember what you said?
No.
He said, about 5%. That was a year ago. And I think the chances have diminished since then to, I don't know if it's 4.5% or 2%, but they haven't gone up, that's for sure.
Thanks to you both. This program has gone on longer than I expected, and it's probably my weakness as a moderator that has extended it so much. But I know that many of you have questions you'd like to ask to our speakers. And Mark Pickus, if you'd come up and explain how that part of the program will work, then we can go right into questions.
Hi, as Martha has mentioned, we are aware that many of you are going to have questions. If you didn't get a chance on the way in to get index cards, there are going to be some people coming around right now with index cards. If you hold up your hand, if you, at any point during the questions and answers, if you decide you want to ask a question, we will definitely come around with index cards to make sure that you get them. We'll be collecting those now. I want to repeat one of the things that Dean did mention earlier, which is the types of programs that the Committee for a Just Peace in Israel and Palestine has been able to bring to Oak Park have been only possible through the fundraising that our own organization has done. We have no type of funding like the other side has with deep pockets. I know that you're aware that we're going to be having some upcoming speakers, including the ones from who are going to be coming to talk about the divestment issue. Liat will be coming from the West Coast, and Shamai will be coming from the East Coast. We have to fly them in, put them up. So I want you to be aware that when we have these kinds of programs, there are expenses to publicize them, to rent room space. So if you can, when we pass the basket around, to give us some donations. If you don't have anything with you right now, I would like to remind you that we do have these types of cards right here in an envelope. And if you need those, raise your hand and we'll make sure that you get those. They can be filled out and you can...
Do you have the cards to write questions?
They can be filled out and you can give us your donation later. We really do appreciate that. That's the only way this type of program can be continued. So, raise your hands. Is there anyone who has not gotten a pencil and a card?
Yes.
Okay, so we need pencil and cards down here. And when you're done writing your question, if you'll also wave the card, we'll have some people during the question and answer period continually coming around to collect them. I'm done, so let's get started.
I'm going to launch right into the first question. It's the only question I have in hand. So, and I just ask that the speakers respond as briefly as possible so we can cover as much ground as possible. This is the first question. How does the panel respond to Cheney's comment about Israel bombing Iran's nuclear facilities?
I don't really have any insight to that question.
Thanks for your brevity.
Well, I won't be surprised if Israel does it sometime in the next year or two. That's all I can add.
Would you agree that this intifada is essentially over and has failed? If so, why did this happen and what can be done about it? Norman, you want to start?
Okay. I was a skeptic about this new intifada from the very beginning. First of all, I thought, as I said at the time when I was asked about it, I didn't even think the language was appropriate. The first intifada from December 1987, you can debate when it was over. The first intifada was a genuine mass uprising, and it was, in my view, and I don't have time now to go into it, it was remarkably successful. It created huge problems for Israel, and I think it had a pretty good chance of succeeding had not the external leadership of the Palestinians wrecked it. The second intifada, most Palestinians were passive observers, which is typical of terrorism generally. They weren't active participants. It would be inaccurate to say that it didn't move the Israelis. It is interesting to study the public opinion polls. Before the second intifada, about 20% of Israelis were willing to sanction some version of a two-state settlement, though not a full Israeli withdrawal. By the third or by 2003, it had moved up to about 40% of Israelis, roughly, were willing to support a two-state settlement and a full withdrawal. So the terrorist attacks on Israel did move Israeli public opinion. The question is, leaving aside the morality issue, and I'll leave that aside for a moment, for the, on the political side, were these, was there a likelihood that they would have succeeded in tipping the balance in Israeli society? And my answer to that is probably not. I think they probably reached the peak of their political effectiveness in moving about 40% of the Israeli population. So, again, leaving aside the moral issue about which I have strong feelings, but I'm not sure if that's the question that's being asked of me, on the strictly political level, I did not hold up much hope for the second intifada, basically because it wasn't a popular massive resistance. And at this point, I think it's fair to say that it failed. To be honest and fair, we have to also acknowledge that I could have been wrong and it might have succeeded. The problem is Palestinians have no strategy. There are different groups pursuing different aims, different aims, but more importantly, different tactics. The tactics collide, they conflict. There is no organized resistance. There's no organized, comprehensively organized anything there. And that's a responsibility which the leadership has to bear. I remember when there was discussions about organizing resistance around the wall, somebody told me they went to speak to one of the heads of the Palestinian leadership about organizing around the construction of the wall. And his response was, we're not a resistance, we're a government. That's the problem.
Well, I agree completely with Norman with regard to the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority, which considers itself the government of an imaginary state and acts as if it's the government of an imaginary state and takes no responsibility, doesn't attempt to defend Palestinians on the ground. In fact, is now defending Israel, defending Israelis against Palestinians, which is a shameful and shocking situation, and just shows how far, and is being fully applauded by the international peace process industry, which is supposedly going to bring about a Palestinian state. Now, has the Intifada failed or succeeded? It depends on what. When you have people in the situation the Palestinians are in, when the goal of Israel is their annihilation as a political and social entity, the destruction of the Palestinian identity, that has always been Israel's goal, to make sure there was no such thing as a Palestinian identity or nationality or collectivity. And that has survived, and it has been steadfast in surviving. Then Israel has failed. Israel, after 60 years of doing what it's done, of sparing no cruelty, has failed utterly, utterly to break the Palestinian people, to break their society, despite the fact that they now have a quisling leadership, as Norman put it, they are still there. They haven't given up on their rights. And I think, you know, often intifada gets conflated with violence. And it's very important to remember that it was Israel. Even though Mahmoud Abbas has adopted the Israeli narrative that the Palestinians, quote-unquote, militarized the intifada, it was Israel that responded to mass popular protests with extreme brutality in September, October 2000. And these protests were not just in the West Bank and Gaza, but within Israel itself, among the Palestinian citizens of Israel. And Israel used live bullets against its own citizens, and much more against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And that is what militarized it. And Yitzhak Lahor got the statistics from the Israeli army that within the first 30 days, the Israeli army fired 1.3 million bullets in the West Bank and Gaza. And the result of that was clear. Dozens of Palestinians were killed before a single Israeli was killed in Palestinian counter-violence. And so we mustn't tell the story as if the Palestinians launched the violence. Whether or not Palestinians should have defended themselves with weapons or not is a debatable question. But let's at least be clear about what happened.
I want to totally agree with that. There's no dispute on that. The ratio of Palestinians to Israelis killed in the first 6 months was 20 to 1. And actually, those million shells, it was in the first 3 days of the Intifada. It's been mistranslated as the first 3 weeks. It was actually within the first 3 days they fired a million shells, the Israeli army. There's no dispute on that. The only question is, what do you do with that situation? And that's where we may disagree.
This is a cluster of questions that are all somewhat related. So I'm going to read all three, and then you can answer. One listener would like to hear Professor Finkelstein, his view on the need for Israel for a Jewish individual. Someone asks, on a panel at Rutgers, I proposed that a single state with equal rights for all under the law could be what we should work toward. The Israeli chairing the panel warned the audience that this was code for the destruction of the state of Israel. What should my response to this have been? And then someone requesting that I repeat a question that never was answered about how to address the concerns among many Jews about the necessity of a Jewish state because of historical conditions under which the Jews have suffered persecution and anti-Semitism, and how we deal with the fact that many people have a very strong feeling in support of Israel on that basis.
Well, these questions obviously can't be discussed in the abstract. They can only be discussed concretely. I happen not to be a nationalist. It's not my cup of tea. And so notions of peoples needing states as a kind of affirmation of one's identity, just as an ideological level, they don't appeal to me. But people are allowed to disagree on, you know, points of theory and abstraction. Where problems arise, obviously, come in practice. I can see, this is one of my problems in life, I can always see both sides of a question. Certainly, Israeli Jews have justifiable fears now. If you've carried on the way Israelis have the last 100 years, and if you carry on the way they've had carried on the last 30 years, any rational person would have fears about retribution. So the fears of Israelis, to me, it seems, are perfectly rational. And there's an argument in the abstract about wanting to preserve a way of life. And I can understand that also. But the question is, in practice, whether the right to preserve a way of life can include the right to deny other people an equality of rights. Take the case of the American South. During the period of desegregation, if you went to the South, the main claim by white Southerners was
They wanted to preserve that Southern way of life. And that Southern way of life meant, basically, a white supremacist state in the South. So, in order to integrate the South or break down the Jim Crow system, it necessarily meant you were destroying a way of life. Now, was that legitimate, destroying that way of life? I think the answer by most Americans nowadays would be yes, because that way of life meant the denial of basic rights to a segment of the population. You turn to South Africa, whites both wanted to preserve a way of life, and they had very real fears about majority rule. Real fears that were based, one, on a centuries-long system of oppression, and two, real fears based on some racist stereotypes about blacks and what would happen if Africans came to power. Nonetheless, did those real fears, and in some cases justifiable fears, of South Africans, did they constitute a veto over the equal right of African blacks to enjoy their rights? I think the answer is clearly no. So I can't accept an argument that says Jews want to preserve a way of life if preserving that way of life, or if preserving that state means the denial of rights to somebody else. That's just plainly illegitimate. There are ways of trying to work out formula for people to have group rights within one state. The usual formula in the case of Israel-Palestine is the binational formula. I'm not sure how realistic it is, I'm not sure how practical it is, but what I am clear on is that you cannot use arguments about fears or wanting to preserve a way of life or even historical suffering as a legitimate grounds, for denying elementary and basic rights to anyone else.
I completely agree with that. What I want to add is to say something about, you know, the question, and it's something I hear often when I speak, that, you know, anyone who opens the discussion about a binational state or a single state, that that's code for the destruction of Israel. Well, you know, it may be. There may be people who mean it that way. But let me say what I mean when I open this discussion. To me, there is no contradiction between Israelis preserving a way of life in whatever future entity occurs. In fact, you could have an arrangement like Belgium, which is a binational state. And I grew up in Belgium, and I know it very well just how bitter the ethnic linguistic divide is in Belgium. Or Canada, or, you know, there are any number of places that are successful, peaceful democracies which manage very bitter, deep, historic, ethnic disputes. It's not all bad news. So, to me, there's no problem with Israelis preserve that with a future democracy, binational state, being a Jewish state, in the sense that it is the home for the Jewish people as much as it is the home for the Palestinian people, preserving the law of return, so that any Palestinian could come and live in the state, and any Jewish person could come and live in the state. That it preserves the language, the culture, the none of these things are incompatible with democracy. In fact, democracy tends to enhance them. If you look at our country, there's much more expression of different ethnic identity, different language, than there was in the 50s or 60s when we all had to suppress our original ethnicity and pretend to be white Anglo-Saxons. Democracy actually allows people more self-expression. And so I think that Israel today, as constituted, is actually destroying the possibility for Jewish and Israeli interaction with the surrounding cultures, to which they're closely related. I mean, one of the tragedies of Israeli nationalism is that it has helped with Arab nationalism and with the Arab-Israeli conflict to destroy the Arab-Jewish identity. So, you know, Arabs, and we now think of these as contradictory identities, and you see all these panels about Arabs and Jews getting on together. But what if you're Arab and Jewish, as people historically were? Where has that identity gone? In Israel, it was suppressed. So all the Arab Jews who came to Israel, had to, their Arab identity became inferior and suppressed. So I think that freeing ourselves from the need for attaching political power to our ethnicity actually allows our identity to flourish. And, you know, just objectively, has Israel been a success in providing that sense of safety and security to Jewish people who feel that it ought to? And I would suggest that, you know, it has helped heighten everyone's anxiety. And I wonder then if we should not at least have a discussion about a different way of conceiving of Israeli and Jewish identity and attachment to Israel that doesn't negate them, that embraces the reality that Israelis and Jews are inherent to the story of Palestine, but imagines that identity as not having to be tied to political power and control, especially over another people.
This writer asks you each to give your opinion on divestment.
Well, you know, those are tactical questions. What's the most effective way to bring to bear pressure on Israel? Divestment as one tactic seems to me perfectly valid and a useful approach. And the only problem that's arisen with the question of divestment is how to formulate a slogan for divestment which doesn't seem to be discriminating against Israel as against all other human rights violators. And I think we have, you know, ample material to rightly to fashion a good divestment slogan that conforms to what human rights organizations have themselves called for in terms of the withholding of weapons from Israel and all sorts of other things. But as a practical question, I see nothing objectionable in it. And frankly, all the claims that divestment or calling for divestment of Israel is anti-Semitic, they're just complete nonsense. For obvious reasons, if anyone would reflect on it for just a half moment, during the 1970s, there was a huge international campaign supporting divestment against South Africa. The only major sanctions busters were the United States and Great Britain, then under Reagan and Thatcher. Now, the claim was that South Africa had an appalling system and it should be subjected to these sanctions and divestment. Well, if you even look at, you know, not radical human rights organizations, organizations like B'Tselem, they say in that report I mentioned earlier, Landgraab, they say that Israel has created a society in the West Bank which is unique in the world today. It's unique. And they go through all the kinds of discrimination that occur in the occupied territories, and they say that it's reminiscent of the South African apartheid regime. Well, if sanctions and divestment was a valid weapon to bring down South African apartheid, then logically it must be a valid weapon to bring down a system which even Israeli human rights organizations describe as reminiscent of South African apartheid. So it shouldn't even be, to my thinking, a morally debatable question. The only question is a practical one, whether it's the most effective means for trying to impose pressure on Israel.
I agree with that.
Then let's move on. This is a question related to right of return and restitution for Palestinian refugees. And this writer asks each of you, out of your own context for political outcomes, however you would phrase that, I don't want to peg you one state, two state, or otherwise, but within your own context, how would you each describe a just outcome or a desirable outcome related to the Palestinian refugees?
Well, this has been this issue has been framed as an obstacle that you can do any number of analyses that say that call it the refugee problem, and that that choice of terming it the refugee problem is very interesting because we never hear respectable people talk about the Israeli problem. Because the notion of Israel is utterly normalized, and the notion that Israel's legitimacy should be challenged in any way is out of bounds. So we refer to the refugee problem and not the Israeli problem. But the refugee problem is the Israeli problem, because really the main reason, not the only reason, but the most substantial reason why the refugee issue is so difficult, and we have to pretend the refugees don't exist, the international peace process industry has to pretend they don't exist, is because the refugees pose a tremendous challenge to the legitimacy of Israel. And Israelis say we don't want the refugees back because then we wouldn't have a Jewish majority anymore and we would no longer enjoy a monopoly on power. And we believe that preserving a Jewish monopoly on power, which is euphemized as the Jewish identity of Israel, makes it legitimate to completely exclude the refugees from the political process and, in their absence, to cancel their rights. I just don't believe that that is the case. I believe that that Israel could not have been created without the removal of the Palestinians from their homeland, and there can be no reconciliation or peace in any form, one state or two states or 10 states, without directly and centrally addressing the rights of Palestinian refugees. So the international peace process industry has created all these vague formulas, again, of recognizing the terrible thing that happened to the refugees, but not actually doing anything serious about it. International law is very clear that if you leave your home, you have a right to go back to it. And it's not a question of guilt, it's not a question of fault. So people have tried to debate and say, well, Israel wasn't really responsible for the expulsion of the refugees. They left of their own accord. It doesn't matter. There were Palestinians who were studying abroad at the time their homes were taken over. They were tourists outside the country. They still have a right to choose whether or not they want to come back. And again, I think this is another fundamental reason why we are at an impasse. We're at an impasse when it comes to the issue of territorial partition, even before you even begin the discussion of the refugees. And so it's another reason why I'm extremely pessimistic about the possibility of any solution which places as its primary goal preserving a Jewish monopoly on power in Israel. And I'm much more interested then in a discussion about how to get the rights, how to allow Palestinian refugees to exercise their rights, whether they want to come back or not, and how to do that in a way that allows Israelis to continue to live for the first time in peace and security. That's where I think the discussion needs to start. But that, again, my position is considered extremist in the context of where the international consensus is today. You have to be against the right of return to be admitted into the international peace process at this point.
I want to just briefly comment on the last statement
because I think it's factually not true. And we're now creating, I'm afraid, another kind of myth. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they are not radical organizations. They're not the best, but they're very far from the worst, and they're pretty solidly mainstream. In fact, you could say a little bit conservative. I was surprised, I was just reading the other day Nelson Mandela's autobiography, and he mentioned the irony. He said, here I am, the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, but Amnesty International steadfastly refused to adopt me as a prisoner of conscience because I advocated the right of South African blacks to resort to violence to overthrow an illegal regime. So, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, or I won't go into it now, the question of UN resolutions. In 2000, when the Camp David Accords opened up, the Camp David negotiations began, Human Rights Watch sent open letters to Mr. Clinton, Mr. Barak, and Mr. Arafat. They explicitly addressed the question of the right of return. And they were both, Human Rights Watch followed them by Amnesty, were very explicit, under international law, Palestinians have an absolute right of return. To make themselves perfectly clear on that topic, they then proceeded at the very end of the resolution, not the resolution, their statements, to list all the other countries in which they had supported the right of refugees to return. And they said, given our support of the right of Kurds to return, Somalis to return, East Timorese to return, so on and so forth, they couldn't possibly in any way justify not also supporting the right of Palestinians to return. So it's simply not true, to my thinking and my knowledge, that the international community doesn't support this right. There is a problem of practically how to implement it. And I do not want to pretend this is an easy issue to resolve. It is not. And I have too much respect for Palestinians who I know personally, who are refugees, and as one of them told me, my closest friend over there, he lives in Fawar camp, he showed me the room in which he grew up, it was the size of a jail cell in the refugee camp, he comes from a big family, he's the oldest of 28, and it's still growing. And he said to me, I'll tell you the truth, I'm conservative on the refugee question. He's not about to forego the right. The right exists. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And there's no doubt even among relatively conservative human rights organizations about that. As to its implementation, I've said it 1,000 times. Ali says Jews and Arabs can get along, and it's true, some of my best friends are Arabs, and I think they can get along. I'm very confident about that. I've also found that Palestinians are, at the grassroots level, are perfectly reasonable, understanding, and decent. And I have no doubt that if you put them in the room, real representatives of the Palestinians, if you put them in the room with the Israelis, that a reasonable resolution of the refugee question can be worked out. What it will look like, I can't tell you, and out of my respect for Palestinians, refugees in particular, I won't presume to tell you. But I do not believe that it's an obstacle to the resolution of the conflict. I think a resolution can be found that will be reasonable and which the parties can accept. But I can't prove that.
Okay, this is the pile of unanswered questions. I don't know if this is a bad sign or a good sign, but it's what it is, and we've got to go. I want to remind you that there are books for sale, and I'm hoping Ali and Norman will stay here for a while, so if you want a book autographed, you can have that. But we need to get out because the high school requires it. Thank you very much for coming.